about the white blood cells. They spring from primitive non-differentiated stem cell lines that go on and on and on and on, and that's the basis for why we don't run out of cells up to a point. So stem cells is kind of, along with nerve cells, and to a lesser degree heart cells, and there's probably a few other little cells hiding around someplace that are relatively long-lived. And just as a little asterisk, I also we mentioned women's egg cells. They're not as long-lived as nerve cells and stem cells, but they're rather long-lived when you keep in mind that women produce their egg cells during their adult life, but in while they're fetuses in their mother's womb. All the eggs that a woman carries up until menopause have developed and are sitting there quietly waiting for their time before a woman is even born. So they're rather long-lived, but not quite as long-lived as, say, stem cells and heart cells, as nerve cells, rather. So that's my little puzzlers for tonight. I hope they amused you. I hope you learned a little something or made you think a little bit. If you have any questions or topics or any kind of comments now, you can ask me. Otherwise, I'll move on to the stories that I have available. Okay. If any of you are near a computer and want to go on, have a web page that they can open, it would be probably a nice idea to take a look at roy.ac2gs.com, because I have a picture there. And I think it might amuse people. It's kind of difficult to really demonstrate a visual illusion on the radio, but I'm going to try it with the help of my web page. Anyway. It's a bizarre and brilliantly effective optical illusion that went viral recently on the internet. It tricks your brain into seeing color images, but if you look closer, you'll notice that the photos you're staring at are only black and white. Created by a digital media artist and software developer, a guy by the name of Kolas, as an visual experiment, the technique which Kolas calls the color assimilation grid illusion achieves its effect by simply laying a grid of selectively colored lines over an original black and white image. Quote, an oversaturated colored grid overlaid on a grayscale image causes the grayscale cells to be perceived as having color, quote, Kolas explained on his Patreon page. So, what's going on here is to make your brain actually interpret this black and white picture as a full color image. According to vision scientist Bart Anderson from the University of Sydney, the effect we're seeing in this illusion isn't particularly surprising. Let me drop for a sec. The color system is what vision scientists refer to as low pass, i.e., many of the receptive fields that color codes are quite large. So the grids get averaged with the achromatic background, which then gets attributed to that part of the image. In other words, your brain kind of compresses visual information when we look at things, giving us an overall impression of what there is if we don't take the time to examine the object too closely. Or you might say a little bit of color goes a long, long way. Some of the people in that photo hadn't given permission for it to be shared online, and Kolas kind of gave out some even more pictures, and one of them is the one that I put up there. So you can do the same thing with raster of dots. You can do it with half-toning. You can do it with all kinds of things. It's sort of fascinating. And actually, Eric used to discuss this when he talked about how the resolution of color doesn't really require high resolution. If you get the intensity of the light right at high resolution, you can cheat on the color code and produce a lower resolution color mask, and the human eye will not perceive it. We don't really do that type of processing. So if you go to the webpage and take a look, you can sort of see what I'm talking about. It looks like a color photograph to me, although if you blow it up a little bit, it's definitely not. It's black and white with some colored grids. This is AC2GS, and I will drop for any comments or questions.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I remember Eric used to mention that this is why in the old NTSC television standard, the bandwidth of the Cromer channel was much less than the luminance channel. It was a lower bandwidth system for the chrominance estimation. Good.
Yes, exactly. And this is a very nice optical illusion trick that brings that concept home. When Eric says it, when I read it, it sounded reasonable. But it's interesting to actually have an image that sort of just shows it to you up front. That's one of the reasons why I thought that this particular visual illusion was worth the effort of bringing to people to give them a little bit more of a look at how we kind of trick our eyes and our senses trick us. They try and make things as simple as humanly possible. They try to squeeze the most amount of information and the smallest amount of packages. And sometimes they get it right enough for our survival, but sometimes they cut so many corners that these visual and auditory illusions are evident. So you're right. And again, anyone who wants to can look at roy.ac2gs.com. There's a link to other articles that have other pictures demonstrating the same principles.
KC2FYJ with comment.
Yes, FYJ.
When I was young, I used to have a book full of optical illusion brain teasers, and one of them was a sort of, I won't call it a checkerboard grid because it wasn't, but it was columns of alternating full columns of white, alternated with columns that were white, black squares, and set up so that you had columns of white and you also had rows of white, interspersed with columns of white, black, and rows of white, black. And as a result, let me let this drop. In the row-column intersection of all white, in between the sort of at the diagonals of where the black ones were, you would see color that wasn't really there. And you could prove that it wasn't there by covering up the black and white that was around it, and the square would look white. But when you let the black reappear, all of a sudden you would see a color in that space.
Ones that if you stared at long enough, you saw three-dimensional images. I was never terribly good at that. They published a bunch of books with those odd images. It just gave me a headache. But the ones that you mentioned, there's loads of them. There are color illusions where they take the same color and they put it next to a darker area so it looks like it's a shadow, and your brain tells you it's a shadow, and so your brain tells you that is a darker color than the one that's in a white background, and then you put the two of them together and it's the same exact color. So it's what's going on is that people kind of simplify vision as a projection shelf, that there's almost just a light tube that's connecting your retina to the back of your head and your brain is just watching a movie. But unfortunately, it's way more complicated because the nerve cells do not have the signal rate that's necessary to do that. So they have to do a lot of their own compression. The way that they do it is they compress instead of large patches of light and dark. They only transmit information about the borders between the contrasts. And then they code the shape of the borders. And then they add a little bit of information about the color, and they reintegrate it in your occipital cortex of your brain where your vision center is. So there's a lot of interesting ways that you can trick your eye into seeing things that aren't there. There are cross-hatched images where you think you see little dots in between the cross-hatches, but when you cover up the area other than where the dot is, the dot goes away because the dot is a incorrect coding in your retina and being decoded in your brain. So it's a very, very, it's a great demonstration that we don't think of our vision the way our vision works. And it doesn't really answer the question, which is, it goes back to the old days of when we were talking about putting implants into people's brains. We don't know how to talk to brains yet. They're very, very complicated, and they talk in code, and not that they encrypt it, but they compress it, and we don't know the algorithms yet. Other questions or comments about this, or I'll move on to the next story.
VDH with a quick comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, there was an interesting little segment on 60 Minutes tonight where they were using, I think it was at MIT, they were one of these groups, they were doing far-out research, and they showed, I think it was an interface where they could take the information that was going to the vocal cords and actually use that nerve information as an interface going into a computer where that person was actually able to surf the net by moving his facial muscles or I think it was his vocal cord muscles. Go ahead.
Yes, I've read about that. It kind of sounds a little bit better than it does when you read the articles, because it's not like it has a big vocabulary. What they have effectively done is they use artificial intelligence routines to grab all the electromyographic output of a body, a face, and compile it and test it over and over and find a few patterns that are consistent with words. So I don't know what the vocabulary, but I don't recall it being terribly large, and the error percentage probably wasn't great either. So it's of great interest. It's kind of the blunt tool. What ultimately you want to do someday, if you're able to, is to just get to the proper cell lines and tap the signals. You know, I mean, you might need a probe, or you might be able to use a superconducting magnetic interferometer to do it, but to truly decode it and be able to read it. This is sort of like a guesstimate based on a law of averages based on some artificial intelligence programming.
Yeah, I suspect that it required a large amount of training of the AI routines to be able to recognize it anyway. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the case with artificial intelligence. The more time you train it, the better it gets at it. It's a point, though, of diminishing returns. I after a certain amount of, after 1,000 hours for some situations, it's not going to improve that much more. So it's a combination of things. It's the final error rate. It's the number of words it can detect. And again, it's not the final. It's the very beginning of the route that neuroscientists really want to be able to figure out exactly what's going on under the hood. They're not happy with kind of hearing noises from, outside the hood and inferring that the carburetor is bad. They want to really know everything that's going on underneath there. Okay, on to the next topic. For decades, researchers have sought a blood test for beta amyloid, the protein that is a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. Several groups and companies have made some progress, and last Thursday, scientists at Washington University in St. Louis reported that they had devised the most sensitive blood test yet. The test will not be available for clinical use for years, but in any event, amyloid is not a perfect predictor of Alzheimer's disease. Most symptomless older people with amyloid deposits in their brains will not develop dementia. But the protein is a significant risk factor, and the new blood test identified patients with amyloid deposits before brain scans could. That will be important to scientists in conducting trials of drugs to prevent Alzheimer's. They need to find participants in the earliest stages of the disease. At present, a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is not easy to make. Doctors rely mostly on tests of mental acuity and interviews with the patient and family members. Studies have shown that community doctors are only 50 to 60% accurate in diagnosing the condition, about the same as tossing a veritable coin. Let me drop for a second. The new test relies on mass spectrometry, a tool used in analytical chemistry that, with recent technical advances, can find elusive beta amyloid proteins in blood with very high precision. The lead investigator, Dr. Bateman, a neurologist at Washington University, has been working on a mass spectrometer test for 20 years. He and a colleague, Dr. Holtzman, founded a company 10 years ago and licensed patents from their university to commercialize a mass spectrometry test if they ever develop one. Amyloid is a normal brain protein formed from the breakdown of a much bigger protein. No one knows exactly what its function is. Quote, we don't know if it has a function, end quote, said Dr. Susan Schindler, a neurologist and the first author of the new paper. She said it might just be a piece of trash. The idea behind the blood test is somewhat paradoxical. If blood amyloid levels are very low, the patient may well have plaques in the brain. The reason, said Dr. Schindler, is that amyloid is a sticky thing. As it gets trapped in clumps in the brain, levels dip in the blood. The new study involved 158 volunteers, mostly in their 60s and 70s. Most were cognitively normal. They came to Washington University periodically for tests of memory and reasoning and received spinal taps and brain scans. Dr. Schindler and her colleagues used mass spectrometry to test the volunteers' stored blood for beta amyloid. When they asked if the beta amyloid levels predicted the results of PET scans that the patients received over the years. Mass spectrometry identified asymptomatic people as accumulating beta amyloid in their brains when PET scans were still negative. The researchers found the scans only turned up beta amyloid in the brain years later. The researchers combined the blood test results with other factors known to influence the risk of Alzheimer's disease, age, and the presence or absence of a gene variant called APOE4, and found the blood tests were 94% accurate in predicting the presence of plaques, even in mostly asymptomatic people. Let me drop for a second. There is no treatment for Alzheimer's at this time, and very early diagnosis of any disease can be problematic, since it may not progress. So, the first use of this blood test will probably be to screen people for clinical trials of drugs to prevent Alzheimer's disease, said Dr. Wiener, a neurologist at the University of California, San Francisco. Quote, if you are doing a prevention trial, you are looking for evidence of the disease that is silent, he said. About a quarter of the people in their mid-70s are starting to accumulate amyloid and plaques in their brains, but their memories and reasoning abilities are intact. To identify patients for prevention trials, researchers have to perform a lot of PET scans at a cost of about $5,000 apiece. Locating just 1,000 patients for an Alzheimer's prevention trial may cost $25 million in PET scans alone, he estimated. A simple blood test would cost much less. It's fantastic, Dr. Wiener said. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So there was a little study done a while back that gene variant, and that's not naturally in your DNA, but apparently the brain undergoes reverse transcriptase, which takes RNA and makes new DNA out of it, and sometimes that's a faulty process. And they found that AIDS patients who take reverse transcriptase inhibitors don't seem to get AIDS. I'm sorry, don't seem to get Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. There are forms of human cancer that are basically the same reverse transcriptase driven. There's lots of variations on what produces the cancers in the human body. Sometimes people lump everything together into a single disease, but it's a heck of a lot more confusing. The question would be whether, because taking the AIDS medication is not riskless in itself, so is the cure worse than the disease? That's something that no doubt some group is going to be studying.
Yeah, that's the thing. But they took a cohort of 3,000 people who were in their 60s and 70s and had been on this therapy to combat AIDS, and they predicted, the cohort was a lot bigger group, but they predicted they should have had found 3,000 people who had acquired Alzheimer's. And rather than 3,000, they found only one. So they felt that look-back study kind of validated the theory. But who knows?
I mean, that's kind of the problem with most experimental results. You get percentages. You get probabilities. And usually you can go with the probabilities. But they're not binary. They're not yay or nay. So sometimes the studies in some way are not perfect, and the statistical analysis is not definitive, and too many conclusions. I mean, the journals are full of findings in the decades in the past that have been refuted over time. So it's a very interesting finding. I tend to think the numbers are too good. Maybe I'm wrong. I think it's, again, another condition that's multivariant, that has multiple causes. So the idea that just one wonder pill kind of does away with them. But it'll be interesting to find out. We don't know until we do with the studies, and I'm sure they'll do the studies.
Very good. MY2H.
Okay, anyone with any other questions or comments about this, or I'll move on to the next one. Okay, Doug. I am as skeptical as the next guy. Heck, I am probably more skeptical than the next guy, unless he was born and grew up in places like Brooklyn. But for anyone still waiting for some mythological white paper that will offer irrefutable proof on the subject of global warming, sometimes coincidences aren't necessarily just coincidental. We've never recorded a hotter month on Earth than the one we just lived through, according to a preliminary data kept by the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Program. The data is based on the first 29 days of the month of July and shows the planet as a whole was 1.2 degrees Celsius, that's 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit for us, above the pre-industrial average. Because July is generally the hottest month on Earth, that makes July the hottest month on record. Adding in the last days of July will likely result in a small adjustment. The World Meteorological Organization tweeted that its last month has equaled, if not surpassed, July 2016, which previously set the record for the hottest month on the books. Either way, the data shows it was hot as hell. Of course, nobody feels the global average temperatures, but then billions of people around the world have felt the sizzle this July. A number of cities in Europe set their all-time high temperature marks during a blistering heat wave that made up to 100 times more likely due to climate change. That then moved to Greenland, setting off a nearly unprecedented meltdown of the island's massive ice sheet. The eastern half of the U.S. roasted. Fires are blazing across the Arctic, and even Australia had its third hottest July on record, raising the risks of wildfires as the country moves into spring and summer. Let me drop for a sec. It's real for programs that track the global average temperature to release preliminary data. But Jonathan Fowler, a spokesperson for the WMO, told Earthers that given importance of global engagement around the challenges posed by climate change and its impact, there was a appetite to release the figures at the highest international level as soon as the month ended. The inexorable rise in temperature is strongly believed to be largely driven by carbon pollution humans have chucked in the atmosphere for more than a century. But there are natural climate patterns that can send temperatures to new heights or depress them slightly. One of these patterns is El Niño, a natural climate shift that happens every few years and is characterized by warming of waters in the eastern Pacific. Those warm waters help heat the planet, which is why El Niño years tend to be hotter than years where there's no El Niño or its cooler counterpart La Niña is in place. You might recall that in 2016 was the year of the Super El Niño, which helped boost July 2016 to its record-setting status. In comparison, 2019 has had an extremely weak El Niño. That makes the preliminary records all the more shocking, to say nothing of this June also taking the title of hottest June on record. We've still got 5 months left in the year, but the intense heat so far has already ensured that 2019 will go down as one of the five warmest years in recorded history. It's just a question of where it will land. Oh, and the 2010s will be the hottest decade humans have recorded. Let me drop for a sec. So, is it all man-made, or is it all nature having a good time at our expense? Well, I don't know for sure, but I do know that the preponderance of scientists that investigate these things for a living have a rather one-sided opinion that modern technology has helped this thing along. To paraphrase an old quotation, you can just complain about the weather, or you can figure out a way to help fix it, or at least you can actually give it a try. So, what do we got to lose? Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
KC2FYJ with a comment.
Yes, FYJ.
I note recently a little squib that I saw, I believe, on the weather.com, that indicated that Anchorage, Alaska had an all-time record high temperature just a week or two ago. That goes hand in hand with that story.
Yes, indeed, and I'm sure everyone who's watched the news have seen those pictures from Iceland of lots of ice kind of falling into the sea. It doesn't look pretty. Apparently, they predict that all of that ice that went into the sea rose the average height of the oceans by something like half a millimeter. Now, half a millimeter doesn't seem like a heck of a lot, but it's not a great trend.
Ed Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
So I caught something on TV also about group that's looking into the areas on Earth that can be reforested, so they're out planting multitude of trees, and what that'll do is it will take the carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the wood trees.
As long as they don't turn around and burn the trees.
Reforestation is a great idea. What's troubling is I read articles about Brazil. The government there is sort of, it's deja vu all over again. They're not particularly interested in saving the Amazon. They've decided to monetize it. So one country is going to grow more trees and the other one's going to burn more down.
I mean, Haiti has a big problem with mudslides, and that was because of all the deforestation. So, times the short-term buck profit, trumps the long-term policy.
Ultimately, it's the way, unfortunately, we're wired. We're wired for short-term gains or losses. We're not really terribly well-wired for the long haul. I think that's part of the weird ambivalent response of it's not going to happen, and if it does, it's a fait accompli, so you might have fun, as well have fun until the end comes. So it's strangely reminiscent of when I was a child reading my Superman comics about Jor-El telling people that Krypton was going to blow up, and everyone kind of told him to shut up.
Well, he got smart and put his kid on a rocket. It's a crazy planet.
He came from a red planet. The idea of a yellow planet would make him superpowered. So we would have to go and ship some poor baby to a blue planet, to a blue star planet, for that to work if we were living in a comic book.
FYJ with another comment.
Yes, FYJ.
Apparently, the country of Ethiopia claims that it planted over 350 million trees in one day on or about July 30th of this year.
Ah, gosh, human beings, you gotta love them. What can I tell you? People are not the most honest things in the world, so, yeah. That doesn't surprise me that they're trying to pull something like that. But, you know, again, that's our lesser nature. Humanity is a complicated thing. I tend to not believe that we are innately good and decent and wonderful and brilliant, nor are we inherently miserable, evil creatures. We have our pluses, we have our minuses, we have our lesser and better angels to point the way, and you have to hope for the best. You have to hope that eventually, I think that the younger people are actually stopping from being just kind of bored with the universe and playing video games, and they're actually starting to look at the numbers and realizing that when they reach our age, they're going to need a lot of sunblock.
C2IS comment.
Yes, Bill.
I think I heard the same news report as the other person in regard to Ethiopia, and I don't think that was just some, marketing thing. They seem to have sort of mobilized nearly their entire country. If the numbers are correct, around 300 million, that means that they would have planted, and these are seedlings, right? Very small. So they would have planted three for every citizen they had. Supposedly their military was involved distributing materials and supplies and so forth. It was a real big thing. I think it got maybe political with the various political parties there sort of competing for number of trees planted. I don't know if I'm imagining that part or not. But apparently this was a real serious effort, and they don't expect the 300 million trees to survive, because, care and feeding for that many trees is probably a lot more effort to make sure that they would survive for any reasonable length of time. AC2IS.
KC2FYJ with follow-up.
FYJ.
Well, first, I saw the original article on Smithsonian.com, and I just checked online, and you can find an article about it on HuffPost.com as well. And it says the actual number was 353 million, so it probably was 352,987,016 or something silly like that. But it was an effort to combat climate change from the perspective of the Ethiopian government. As far as I can tell, it's a real story, not just some phony baloney thing that someone has put out there, because I found reference to it on several different sites.
Hey, I hope it's true, and I hope a lot of those seedlings grow and do their thing. I'm a little jaundiced with any major claim, especially Ethiopia doesn't strike me as a highly efficient hub of activity, so I kind of am doubtful of it, but, what can you do? But you know, it's sort of important also to maintain these seedlings, because if you keep in mind, I don't know if you remember when the president of France came here, he brought a seedling that they actually planted in the White House lawn. That poor thing ended up dying, by the way. They immediately dug it up and put it in isolation, and it didn't take to the pulling out and digging back in, and it passed away. So just because you plant the seedling doesn't necessarily mean you'll get a tree, but I hope it's true. We need people to actually do the right thing as opposed to look at the profit margin for the next quarter.
This is FYJ again.
Yes, FYJ.
There's a note here that says it was reported by CNN. They planted more than 350 million trees in 12 hours. Officials believe it's a world record. The burst of tree planting was part of a wider reforestation campaign named Green Legacy, spearheaded by Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, something or other. There's dots that make the article continue.
Okay, I wish them well. I tend to be a mildly skeptic people, as I find most people born in Brooklyn tend to be that way. I'm always kind of trying to figure out what people's angles are. CNN is a reputable news organization, but I don't know exactly what their source was. If their source was the government, that's kind of dubious. But I wish them well in their efforts. Hopefully other countries will do something similar. I mean, I couldn't possibly begin to imagine the United States being able to do something like that. And we can occasionally be talked into doing all kinds of great things. I'm not quite sure. It might have been Bill, but the signal broke up with a lot of noise. SOIS. Unfortunately, about one-third of that was distorted by noise, but I understand the way that you look upon these things. You are a person who doesn't believe any of this, that the scientists are either lying or they're doing something else crooked. I don't know exactly why they all would. A profit motive, I don't know where the profit actually is, but I'm sure you know of some profit motive. And, you know, it's a free country. You can believe that global warming is a Chinese plot. You can believe that the Earth is flat. It's one of the many freedoms we have as a citizen of a free country.
CHIS comments.
Yes, Bill.
I was not able to hear most of that transmission, but just based on your recap, I'd like to respond with another news article that came out on the radio recently, which had something to do with the eggs of reptiles and the fact that temperature has a lot to do with the gender of the hatchlings of those eggs. And they're finding that certain sea turtles that live in certain regions are now living in temperatures such that all their offspring are being born with one gender. I think sea turtles probably have a fairly long lifespan, so maybe this will not kill them off. I'm not sure about that, but you know, if that does turn out to be a large effect, a large impact on them, and you know, if their population does decline or if they're wiped out, you know, unlike these other things where you can say any individual storm is never attributable to climate change because, you know, the climate change is not about weather, you could look at these other things and lots of other things, you know, animals migrating based on, you know, climate change. But that would be, you know, one standout thing where you could say, hey, this species was wiped out, and that was due to climate change, AC2IS.
Oh, yes, I read that article. It was a fascinating one. There's a lot of, you know, unfortunately, it's true that there's a lot of climate change that occurs completely free of mankind. The climate has been moving all over the place since the Earth started to cool down. The only problem is that we're now involved, and do we take some responsibility for it, no responsibility for it? Do we act in any way against it, or do we just make believe it isn't there and hope it goes away? I don't think that that's the best approach. I mean, there's got to be some kind of interesting compromise someplace in the middle. You can't just go for the next quarter's dividends. You have to look at longer pictures. So even if global warming is not caused by humanity, if there is a sense that things are going up and that's going to cause all kinds of problems, like my house is going to be underwater eventually, I think we should look into whether there are remedies or at least things to slow this down. I think that's reasonable among reasonable people.
AC2FYJ.
Yes, FYJ.
Okay. The Earth precesses on its axis with a period, I believe, of about 20,000 years. The question that always has puzzled me is, does that precession have anything to do with climate change? I would think that it would, but I would also be open to arguments that it doesn't. Anybody have any thoughts?
C2IS, comment.
Yes, Bill.
I'm not 100% sure that this precession that was just mentioned is the same thing that is sometimes referred to as global wobble. But global wobble as a impact on, you know, or an explanation for climate change has been, I believe, thoroughly debunked. Possibly Bush administration science advisor was kind of ambushed with that theory, quote unquote, by Congress as he was testifying in front of Congress, and he had knowledge of the, you know, global wobble theory and was able to refute it on the floor of Congress. Guessing maybe that was Professor Marburger, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And back to you for any other comments, AC2IS.
Okay, Bill. The problem, unfortunately, is that this is very, very complicated. Not only does it have to do with orbital mechanics, it has to do with a whole bunch of interacting Earth-based forces. Particulate matters, volcanic eruptions, gas, greenhouse effects, you name it, it interacts. And it's very difficult to make a terrible amount of sense out of it. It's the closest thing to weather-like chaos theory in action than anything else I can think of. So the answers, I don't think, are simple. There are a whole bunch of different mechanisms that push and pull at weather patterns and at climates and at temperature shifts. The world had a mini ice age only about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and because of that is the reason probably why North America was colonized by its earliest people going through iced land bridges that no longer exist. But again, I think it's silly to say this is all nonsense and it's all a bunch of crooked scientists. I think it requires a great deal more investigation and actually coming up with some ideas where you can lessen the extent of what seems to be going on. I mean, of course, you can close your eyes and make believe it ain't there, but I don't think that's the wisest approach.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I suspect that the precession of the Earth's rotation wouldn't change the length of the season so much as it would change their phase. In other words, maybe winter, instead of being December, January, February, might be January, February, March, or March, April, May, something like that. We'd still have our same length of seasons, but I think there would be a shift of when they would occur as rotated around through the year. Go ahead.
FYJ again.
Yes, FYJ.
If the average axis of the Earth's rotation were 90 degrees to its orbital plane, I would be inclined to agree with that. But it isn't, and so what the precession can potentially do is change the amount of time that sunlight is blasting onto the pole, the North Pole, or the South Pole for that matter, and therefore increase the amount of time during which that polar cap can melt, which will have other deleterious effects on the climate because of the way that fresh water interacting with the oceans will change the salinity current, which has been tempering the Earth's temperature for thousands of years. Just further thought.
Yeah, like they say on Facebook about relationships, it's complicated. But I think it's important to get to the bottom of it, and I think the worst approach is to just go, yeah, there's nothing wrong, let's just go on with our lives. Maybe it's all those readings of Superman comic books when I was a little kid or something, but I don't know, that doesn't strike me as the best offense.
Comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, I think with precession, it's the axis of rotation of the Earth would trace out a circle, so the orbital tilt would still be the 23.5 degrees, except that at different times of this 20,000-year cycle, whatever it is, that would be occurring at different times. The tilt would still remain the same. It's just that the axis of rotation is, if you look at over this long period of time, is tracing a circle. So in that sense, I don't think your winters would be any longer or shorter. It's just that they would have rotated around the year cycle.
FYJ, you
want
to comment about that?
I have thought about that, but consider the following hypothetical. Let's say, for the moment, that the angle of the Earth's rotation was 45 degrees to the plane of the orbit, and that it was aimed, well, it doesn't matter because it'll change as the Earth goes around the sun, but if the average angle is 45 degrees, and the rotational precession brings it to, I'm going to make numbers up, a famous phrase from Dick, the angle of precession shifts to only 40 degrees, the amount of light hitting the polar cap is going to be reduced substantially while it's at 40 degrees, And at the other end, when it's shifted to 50 degrees, the amount of light hitting the polar cap is going to be vastly increased for half of that precessional period. Now, given that, the angle of rotation is only a few degrees from vertical, and so maybe the impact won't be as great, but I would still tend to think that it would be measurable. Again, this is just my own thoughts. I don't have any papers to point to back it up. It's just my own thought process. Any further comments?
Yeah, comments.
Yeah, sure, John.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding precession, but I thought precession is the axis of rotation traces out a circle over a long period of time, so the total tilt would stay the same at its 23.5 degrees. But if you could look at the Earth over a long period of time, you would see that sometimes it was 23.5 degrees one way, sometimes it was 23.5 degrees another way, if you looked at it at the same point at every year. So if I think maybe I'm misunderstanding precession, but I thought precession is the axis itself would trace out a circle over a long period of time.
Okay. If think of a top that spins. A top, when it's spinning, does not stay vertical. It tips around and it draws a circle in the air, and that is precession. And my point is that while it's tipped more towards the sun, you're going to have more sunlight hitting that top of the top, so to speak. And when it tips away, you're going to have less, you know, when it gets more upright, you're going to have less of the sun hitting that top. Now, maybe I've got the geometry wrong in my head, and I'm perfectly willing to admit that. That's why I say it's just my own thoughts rumbling around up here. And I'm perfectly delighted to accept that I'm wrong if someone can point it out to me.
Yeah. I might be mistaken on that, too. I think the cycle you're talking about is the winter-summer season. I mean, in the summer, the northern hemisphere, our summer, the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun, and in our winter, it's tilted away from the sun. But the precession would be a long period rotation. If we could see the Earth at say, the same point every year over a long period of time, we would see that axis of rotation has traced out a circle. So I think, I may be wrong, but I think it would shift the phase, if you like, of the seasons rather than shift their length. I don't think the actual angle of the Earth's axis changes with precession. It just changes the time that it would be tilted towards or away from the sun.
AT2OIS.
This is FYJ. You may be right, and I may have the geometry wrong. But that's why I bring it up, so that we can talk about it. This is FYJ clear. KC2FYJ clear.
Okay, very good. And welcome, Harry. Glad to have you aboard here. Please come back. The problem, again, is things are complicated, and there's more than one precession. I think what Harry is alluding to is a 25,000-year precession on the axis of the Earth that causes these slight differences, as opposed to the small seasonal precessions that give us, the summer and the winters and such. So there's a lot going on there, but Mark wants to say something. I hope your signal's a little bit better so that we get more of the information that you want to transmit to us.
As far as I've read, there was a polar shift, or we're in the middle of a polar shift, or I think it was 10 degrees. And just to bring up a case, there was a guy, I think he was in the corporate, that set up. This
Mark. Unfortunately, we only got about 20%. I haven't heard anything about a 10 or 15% polar shift. I'm not quite sure what that means. There's a lot of material out there. That's one of the problems. We live in a unregulated information age where there's probably a lot more stuff that's complete nonsense out there than there is stuff that's legitimate. And everyone lives in their own cocoon and takes their own source materials. I tend to take published peer-reviewed articles over people who write blogs that I don't know who they are. But again, it's a free country. You're free to believe all kinds of things, and God knows people are doing that. So I'm just trying to remind people that there's something going on, and we should look behind the curtain or something, because if we don't, it's going to bite us someplace. That's all I'm trying to get across to you guys and gals.
FYJ with another comment.
Yes, Harry.
I think that the polar shift that he was alluding to is a shift of the magnetic pole, which the scientists know do a flip every X number of tens of thousands of years. And it is believed that we are well overdue for a flip of the magnetic poles, and that may be what he was referring to.
Okay, that's possible. It doesn't, to me, have a great deal to do with the weather patterns, per se. We actually covered that a few times in the science talk, that the magnetic field of the Earth is very, again, unfortunately, complicated. It has to do with magneto-hydrodynamics, that the Earth's core is rotating, and a conducting material that's rotating produces a magnetic field, but it's able to kind of reverse its magnetic field on the dots. So the South Pole hasn't really moved that much, although the North Pole magnetic pole has been moving rather briskly, to the point where the government shutdown last year slowed down the publication of correction maps, which are very important. So that's true. I'll give them that, but again, that I don't think that's correlated with much of anything. And as Harry mentioned, we probably are due for a magnetic shift, and hopefully it's not going to cause anything particularly wacky. We don't really have any historical records of this ever happening before. They occurred before any human culture, so all that we've noticed is in material like magnetite and such, that at certain times the polarities seem to go in opposite directions. That's my 2 cents worth on our magnetic field, which is very important in protecting us from cosmic radiation and otherwise, but the weather patterns, I'm not quite sure. Right. I want to once again thank everyone who participated tonight. It was loads of fun for me. I hope it was loads of fun for you people. And again, if you have any mailbag questions, if you have any topics you'd like me to concentrate on, if you have any puzzlers, because I could always use puzzlers, then the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@alpha-charlie-2-golf-era.com. And the image that's black and white with colored grids that look like a color picture to most people, you'll see that and links to other articles that I've talked about at roy.ac2gs.com. So once again, want to thank everyone who participated, and I will send it back to Dick so he can send it back to Paul for the space report.
WHYY. What a question for Roy.
Okay, I don't want to take up too much of Paul's time, but what's your question, Joe?
Might be a simple one, might be a complicated one. Probably in your case it's going to be simple. I watched a movie a while ago, actually came out many, many years ago, four, five, six, seven years ago, something like that. It was called The Enigma Machine, and it had to do with the U.S. and Britain working on breaking the encryption code to the German machines that they use to transmit signals to the submarines so they could attack other boats and things like that. They said if we didn't find the code to that, or get a couple live machines to actually know and how to intercept the code with it and break it, that just trying to break the code outright would have been something like 10 to the 144th power, or more than all the atoms in the universe. How could somebody make a statement like that?
I do not know exactly how they came to that conclusion. They might have actually used some form of math, or they might have used some form of hyperbole. Enigma was a very sophisticated code technique. It required a bunch of things. You couldn't certainly do it.